Welcome to an all-new episode of the McFuture Podcast. It's Steve Factor. I'm going to pull a Steven Seagal on you today. He had a reporter come to his house, and Seagal greeted him and said, "You know, I just read the greatest script in the history of movies. You know who wrote it? Me." I don't know why I love it, but that kind of cockiness is almost what you need to succeed in these crazy low probability professions. You have to believe you are the shit. Even the ones that play it off like they're humble. In fact, there's this guy, Dave, I forget his last name. He's got a TV show called Dave, but his rap persona is called Little Dicky, and he's had a bunch of viral YouTube videos. Anyway, the guy is a successful kind of jokey white rapper. He's a guy who kind of makes fun of himself, but if you listen to his interviews and read between the lines, he is a supremely confident person. He believes he is a visionary and he deserves every morsel of fame that he's going to get. Anyway, I was listening to an episode that was only for subscribers called Idiocracy and How We Build It. And it was so good. Look, it's my own work. So who else is, this is like your mom telling you you're beautiful. Yeah, you got to take it with a grain of salt. But it's an episode that is even more salient in light of this coronavirus situation. In the episode, I talk about fragility and how it's embedding itself into our culture. I don't want to go too deep into it because I think it'll give too much away. You should just listen to it. It's great. What I wanted to first talk about is what's happened in the last few months and then hear it through that lens. For a very brief moment, we've kind of returned to survivalism. Let's call it survivalism light. No one was out on the streets. In fact, it was the exact opposite. All right, everybody, get into your houses and order in. Now, don't come out until the delivery guy shows up with your pizza. You know, listen, it's a mission we can accomplish. We're now overcompensating by saying, oh my God, these essential workers, oh, thank God. And they're banging on pots and pans and, you know, celebrating them. Meanwhile, these are people who will be completely forgotten the second everyone's able to leave the house. You'll be crapping on your waiter. You'll be doing all the other stuff you've been doing before, if that's the kind of person you are. So it's not going to change hearts and minds. What is that, Stockholm syndrome, where you fall in love with your captor? I remember when I was on a scholars trip to Greece or Italy when I was at NYU, long before political correctness. And about 4 days into the trip, everyone was hooking up. And my friend turned to me and said, "Remember how ugly these girls were when this trip started?" And I'm sure the girls were saying the same exact thing. But when that's your reality, you adapt. You have to. Situations change aspirations. So your dreams have a container, and that container is not all of reality or fantasy. It's your reality. They're confined. So everything is relative. And with coronavirus, situations have changed massively for some people. I certainly had this. I was doing live events. I can't do live events. My speaking engagements all got canceled. That all disappeared in one shot. So now you have to rethink what your plans are. You know, part of my decision was to leave New York. I'm not going that far. I'm still going to be an hour away. But it's very strange after living here all my life to just pick up and leave. In fact, I have to still pack. We're leaving tomorrow. Maybe I've rationalized this to some extent, but I've been feeling like New York abandoned me rather than I'm abandoning New York. If I think about the New York I grew up in, that my family and I immigrated into, it was completely different. You had all of these immigrant families. First of all, you had families. You had actual real families that still lived here. You had the Italians, the Pakistanis, the Russians, and everything in between. they're all gone. They all, you know, dissipated wherever. And living in Manhattan, especially, or any of the trendy parts of Brooklyn, they're all tourists. It's become this long-term corporate housing. And none of these people have any investment in the place. They have no roots here. They show up. They call themselves New Yorkers for a few years. They'll find a mate. And then they go. There's some psychological burden that I think I've been carrying being around people who just don't care. There is no community. There is no taking care of each other. Everything is outsourced to the state. And that's why you see this difference in mentality between people who live in rural or even suburban areas compared to people who live in big cities. Because the people in big cities realize they're alone. They placed their reliance on the state. And so when you outsource, you take on a very different relationship to others because those bonds become much weaker. Those bonds had gotten so weak for me that the only thing really keeping me here is, you know, I love going out to music events and restaurants and comedy clubs, but all that stuff abandoned me just like it abandoned all the performers and all the people who had aspirations of standing in front of an audience, at least for now. I think those things are going to come back. But for now, everyone is going through kind of a mourning. There's a real mourning, right? Because all of these people actually died. But then there's the mourning for your old life. There's something important about saying goodbye to that. Along with it, you know, when you're moving especially, there's a cleaning house that needs to happen. Sometimes literally, you have to clean your house because it's filthy, but also relationships that aren't nurturing you or places that are creating anxiety or aren't bringing out the best in you. Businesses that weren't working, friends who weren't there for you. I've had two of those. So it's this opportunity to say goodbye. And I live near Central Park, so I've been going to the park pretty much every day. Last couple of days I haven't because we've been packing. But the park is this last sanctuary that's untouched by time, or at least time as I knew it in New York. So it's been this weird process where I'm like, goodbye, tree. Goodbye, squirrel. Not literally, because that would make me insane. But you have these thoughts. Well, when am I going to see any of these things ever again? It's a strange time. There are moments where you start thinking, oh, this sucks. Everything's going to suck. Our old life's not coming back. Or you regroup. You figure out how to maybe cut expenses, maybe in some cases move back with family and just suck it up until you can rethink how you're going to approach this new world. How are you going to spend the next couple of years and who you want to spend it with? This is a huge opportunity to build up these tiny, flaccid muscles that either have never been built or need to badly be rebuilt because we've become so reliant on outsourcing. I mean, there are a lot of rich people struggling without maids right now. And I'd like to take a moment of silence here, but I don't know that that works great on podcasts. The obvious thing is rethinking work and going into the office and living in big cities. But there's so much more to that. It's like, what are my aspirations? How do I want to spend my time? What environment do I want to be in? Am I even essential? Because the government has determined you're probably not if you're on Zoom all day or watching webinars. I think this world, at least for the next year or two, is going to be more restrictive. It's not going to have some of the amenities we were used to, and in other ways it'll have more. But I think it's opening up a lot of opportunities, and it's building up a hunger for human connection. So when people think about, you know, are events going to come back? Is, you know, live performance going to come back? People will crave it more than ever. If the testing and the vaccine work out, in 2 years, people will be so hungry for connection. Spend this time building connections individually, but also at some point capitalizing on that need. because there are only going to be three kinds of businesses in the future. There are going to be scaled monopolies, and these are all the big companies that provide all the essentials that we need, whether it's a car or cleaning supplies or Amazon deliveries, all that stuff. Then there are going to be technology platforms and data platforms. And then the last thing is going to be, I'm going to call them religions. These are businesses people make personal connections with, that they believe in, that they think are going to benefit their lives. It's a very individual, unscalable thing. And yeah, there'll be some startups, but all the startups I'm kind of mentally bundling into either monopolies or platforms, because that's who's going to acquire them. So the only thing left, all these small businesses that everyone's talking about, that everyone is in some cases mourning their loss, maybe prematurely or maybe not, that's it. That's the only thing left. So the extent to which you can build those bonds and those relationships and that belief and that empathy with your business, that's the difference. That's the difference between succeeding and failing in the future that doesn't need you. People can connect with you. People can want to do business with you. People could want your services, but they're not going to need them. This is the time to really think about these constraints that we're working with and what those opportunities will be. And I'm going to get into that in future episodes. So for now, take all this into consideration as I leave you with the original Idiocracy episode, which was never released to the public. It was released to subscribers only. So if you're a Patreon subscriber, which is only $5 a month, you will get all these great episodes long before everybody else. So I'll include the link in case you want to join, but at the very least, share this with others. Anyway, here's Idiocracy, or as I've renamed it, COVIDiocracy, which rolls right off the tongue. Welcome to an all-new episode of the McFuture Podcast. I'm Steve Factor, and today we're going to talk about Idiocracy. Now, I know a lot of people kind of refer to it in jest, but today we're going to talk about the one criteria that will decide if and how our idiocracy gets built. But first, let's start with a basic premise. I think all of us agree, if someone is mentally or physically handicapped, or don't have arms or legs, or is old and poor and doesn't have family, they probably shouldn't ski. I'm joking. What we need to do is take care of them, even though these aren't direct members of our community. Maybe we should have some drug treatment, temporary housing, money to get them back on their feet or teach them some skills to interview or place them in jobs. We all get that. We have the money, and whether you're on the right or left, you might have some ideas as to how we should do it. Some might think it should be local and community driven. Other people think we should have a federal program, but either way, we're all agreeing that we should have some compassion for people and that maybe individual families aren't going to be able to take care of them. But more and more often, we're not just protecting weaker people or weaker characteristics, but we're selecting for them. And there's a huge difference between those two. Think of all of the fragility that's being rewarded all around us. The stuff that I covered in previous episodes, like cancel culture, that's rewarding fragility. If you're on a college campus and you can't handle what a speaker said because you disagree with it, and you start shaking and running to a safe space, or you go online and you try to get someone fired or laws changed so they can't speak, or you start equating words with violence to justify your own meanness and aggression. And I could tell you, words and violence are not one and the same. That's something someone who hasn't been punched in the face would say. And as someone who's been punched in the face, you've heard this podcast, right? You know the difference. And I will take any word or any collection of words over actual violence. And then the people who are demanding special treatment and special terminology. I'm a Zerhat. What? That's right. I'm a Zerhat. That's my antonym. What does that mean? What is an Anthem? What is a Zerhat? By calling me, I mean, not calling me a Zerhat, that is a hate crime. And then we're medicalizing and overdiagnosing everything from ADHD to depression. ADHD barely exists in places like France. Here, everyone is on some sort of drug because it's the easy way out, and we're externalizing everything. God forbid you suggest jogging to someone. You will be in prison. I'm pretty sure you will be arrested if you suggest that exercise might be a good thing for a lot of people and not drugs. And the emotional support animals. It started out innocently enough where people are like, okay, listen, I understand you get triggered by the sound of luggage rolling down the corridor and you must have your Sharpei with you. But now we've graduated to ponies and owls and vultures and snakes. Personally, I cannot wait until we have to fill the entire cabin with water so someone could take their emotional support white shark on there. I think every plane cabin should be exactly like Noah's Ark. Two of every animal. And that way, if the plane crashes, you can rebuild all of humanity. And we're breeding weakness into kids. Peanut allergies didn't exist before. But if you grow up in a bubble and your parents don't let you touch anything, all of a sudden you are now susceptible to those germs. Or if you abuse antibiotics because you can't handle a cough, you're going to breed physical weakness into people. And we're doing the same thing mentally. In New York City, there's a gifted school called Stuyvesant. I didn't get in, but it's filled with super smart kids. And now they're trying to diversify it, which is a noble notion. That's a good thing. We should have more diversity. But instead of helping the kids who are struggling become better so they qualify to get into Stuyvesant, they're smushing down the kids who are doing well. Now, a bunch of them won't be able to get into their program. And I'm sure they'll be fine on some level, but is this what we want to do as a society? And culturally, this stuff is being reinforced. I know someone who's transitioning, and you know how hard it is on them, on their loved ones, their families, their kids. The depression rates and suicide rates before and after transition are super high, but we've culturally trivialized it. Hey, let's have trans people read to kids. Let's have kids transition at the age of 5 to a different sex because they said they want to. Kids don't even know what outfits to wear at that point. When they get to 18, they could do whatever they want. And then we're expecting government to save everyone. Look at all of these helpless people just laying there. How could they possibly help themselves? There is nothing at all in the world that any of them could do to get up off the couch and help themselves. Nothing, not a thing. They just have to lay there until Bernie Sanders saves them. That's insanity. And we've all bought into this. And guess what message that's sending to people who are in those situations? Keep laying there. Lay there still. Someone will send you a check. It's the worst possible message. But that's the thing. We're turning fragility into heroism, but not the act of overcoming fragility. And that's a huge difference. Fragility is getting rewarded, but it's not getting people ahead. Not really. To really get ahead, you still need to be better. So what the people in power are doing is giving concessions, and conceding parties never, ever give up more power than they absolutely have to, unless there's something in it for them. So unless you're bringing something better to the table, you're never going to get more than is written in that concession. So our approach is all wrong. Instead of toughening us up, we're making fragility a desirable trait, something we should seek out or elevate or pretend we have and get a doctor's note so we could have a baby cobra on the plane with us. And this distorts everything. It trades evolutionary fitness for dependence on institutional protection. Government is going to save me. These corporations are going to save me. School is going to create new rules for me. And you know what's going to happen when those institutions fail, either in general or in specific situations? The fragile people are going to be exposed to all of the harshness that they've been shielded from. And they can't survive or thrive in that environment. It's like releasing a chihuahua in the forest. Hey, you came from wolves. Go survive in the wild. Woof, woof. And the minute you release it, a bear eats it. But here's the really insidious thing about all this. The longer we select and reward fragility, the more we guarantee that in the long term, these institutions will degrade and eventually fail from within. So I wrote kind of a less dramatic version of this on my Facebook page at Idea Factory. And a woman who follows the page wrote the following. She said, "I think this may be plausible if you believe that natural selection is occurring for mental characteristics in the same way that it does for physical ones. I've often suggested there might be an evolutionary shift in the human brain happening today that would explain some of the divisions we have in society, especially around violence, tribalism, xenophobia. Thoughts." Well, lucky for her, I have some thoughts. Now, these aren't final by any stretch of the imagination, but I have some strong initial hypotheses. First, I think we've been transitioning to selecting for mental and not physical characteristics over the last 100 years. Because just like we've transitioned from physical work to idea-based jobs or jobs where capital is rewarded more than labor, the mind, not the body, becomes much more important. And just as the outside world starts rewarding it, so does procreation. Now, there are some caveats. Women are the ones who do the choosing of who gets to procreate and who gets to go home and spank it by themselves. And they still carry lots of remnants of biological programming, as do men. But in this case, women are far more important because, again, in a free society, they are the ones who choose. And a perfect example of this was a 60 Minutes episode. It might have been Dateline from the 90s. I don't know. I don't watch any of these shows. I don't even have a TV. I don't know what's on anymore. In this show, they had one of those police two-way mirror rooms where they marched a bunch of guys of varying heights into the room, and then they brought women in to choose who they would date. And the short guys could not get arrested. Even the ones that were more successful, they had to lie to these women and tell them, "Oh, this little guy, he runs Microsoft. He's a billionaire. He invented cups," you know, like anything. And finally, she would break down. She goes, "Okay, maybe I'll meet him for half a cup of coffee." That's the biological programming. And guys have that too. But women are the decision makers. So I suspect over time, these preferences will break down because the definition of what a successful mate is in society is changing. Eventually, all those Guidos that do GTL, that's gym tan laundry, and work construction, they're going to be a lot less successful than the androgynous graphic designer who cries during Frozen. And they may not even be competing for the same mate. And that preference does change over a woman's lifetime. She might make a different choice at age 32 than she did at 22. But the woman's choice of mate is not the end of the story. As women get college degrees in way, way higher rates than men, which is happening right now, and better job opportunities, they're going to look for the same or better in men. But they're doomed to disappointment because just by definition, there are fewer marriageable men who match that intelligence requirement. And when they do make their choice, they're doing it later than they ever have in history and having fewer kids, if any at all. So in aggregate, it's not who your mate is, but who procreates that determines the composition of society and what traits that they're going to carry. And generally speaking, there are higher birth rates among people who are less educated. So this rising preference for intelligence is being completely drowned out by who actually has kids. And we're seeing this happening globally. The average age in Africa and the Middle East is, in some cases, in the teens or 20s. And the average age in Japan and Europe is cadaver. It's almost dead. It's like the high mid 40s. In fact, in Japan, there was a story this week about how Japanese workers, as they age, are now using exoskeletons so they can keep working. Can you imagine how much you have to hate immigrants and babies for that to be a viable option? Come on, Japan, just fuck a little. Just the tip. That's all you need, just the tip. Or let some people in. And I understand they want to keep their society ethnically pure. That always works out. But they're stuck in a shrinking country. If other countries that surround them, like China, outbreed them, they're going to be able to just walk right in. Who's going to defend them? Unless they have lasers installed on their exoskeletons, they're screwed. And the U.S. is getting there too. Because of immigration and higher birth rates, typically among Hispanics, it masks some of the effect. But our average age is rising too. 8 years ago, the birth rate for Hispanic immigrants was 3.9 kids per family. Now it's 2.9. So it's dropped by a whole kid. There's a lost kid somewhere that someone needs to find. Look under Trump's house. There is a kid that he's trying to return to Mexico. And I wrote about this a while back, but Muslims can conquer the world with their genitals, not with war, because of their higher birth rates. They can simply overwhelm the world with population growth and become the dominant majority. And statistically, that's where things are headed if their birth rates don't decline either. So who procreates most is going to decide what physical and mental characteristics are going to dominate. They get to choose what the world looks like. Not precious little darlings who grew up with a Prince Charming fantasy and a dad who paid 200 grand for some Aztec poetry major. And they waited an extra 15 years to settle for some Prince Charmless. That's not who gets rewarded. Not over time. And what traits are winning is only going to become evident over generations. So back to the original question about cultural preferences and biases. I don't think those are tied to evolution necessarily, because they change pretty quickly. They're not part of inherent mental traits that get transferred generation to generation. And the proof of that is all around us. You look at attitudes about homosexuality, for example. They shifted massively over the last 30 years. And it didn't take an evolutionary shift. It's not like we sprouted tails and wings and said, okay, I'm ready for a little Latin guy-on-guy action. No, we're essentially the same people, but the attitudes have changed. And the same thing happened when it comes to sexual norms and mixed marriage and pot and a whole host of other issues. And that didn't require evolution per se. Now, tribalism is a different story. I think it's innate to a lot of species, not just us. And how pronounced or how negative it is going to vary based on technology and birth trends and local culture. For example, people can be tribal at a national level, which could be helpful if they're threatened by a horde of zombies. Or it could be destructive if they suddenly decide they're sick of hummus and the people who make it. Or people can be tribal based on a whole bunch of other characteristics: ethnicity, religion, political group, gender. I think those characteristics bring people closer within those groups, but it creates more conflict between groups. And we're seeing all of that now. And I could be wrong here, but I think a lot of these newer groups, these intersectional romances, where people are creating these flimsy, fashionable, weak bonds online, I don't think they're going to last. Do you think you can get a ride to the airport from your new Twitter buddy? They wouldn't even share their bag of peanuts with you on the plane. Oh, right. There are no peanuts on the plane because they're monsters who made sure to tweet peanuts into oblivion. Anyway, I'm going to think more about this and include elements of it in future episodes. But I also want to connect this to something else I'm working on. If it is true that we're selecting for fragility and all of these other things are happening, people are getting dumber because the education system is failing. Fewer people are working, so they need to fill their time with something, or they're not getting health care, whether it's mental health or physical health. All of these different forces create greater susceptibility to belief systems, and some that are good and others that are destructive. And I'm going to get into that more over time. Anyway, I'm Steve Factor. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share this with a friend, review it on iTunes. It helps get some visibility, and subscribe to the Patreon or get others to subscribe. See you next week. Just the other day, I saw an article in the New York Times that talked about why it's a myth that we need two-parent households. A myth? In the article itself, they disproved that point, which was insane. If I were trying to destroy a culture or a group of people, the first thing I would try to do is to normalize broken homes. And honestly, I have no clue why. I do not understand the motivation. But to deny the basic math of a family unit, two incomes, two sets of grandparents who could potentially babysit, that's just math. And it doesn't have to be a heterosexual or traditional couple. It could be any kind of couple, as long as it's a stable environment for kids. Hell, it could be one of those polyamorous things where you have three, four, five adults. As long as you keep the kids away from the dildos, everything's fine. But to say that in this society, a person who's already struggling to take care of themselves can take care of a kid on their own is insanity. This pandemic, and especially the reaction to people who want to open the economy back up, is where our privilege really starts to show. Because a lot of people, especially the kind of people I know, very spoiled, get a lot of delivery boxes, they will make snarky comments about people protesting because they want the economy to reopen. They can't fathom that anyone else could possibly lead a satisfying life in some other place where their rules don't apply. There's such a lack of empathy there. There are people who don't have the kinds of jobs where they can sit around at home on Zoom. These are people who need to be outside, who need to be working. And also a lot of parts of the country are not like New York or areas that were impacted. They're completely different. They have tons of separation. They probably didn't even need to be closed in the first place. So there's this lack of empathy, but there's also this undercurrent of fear and self-preservation and a form of weakness. Don't dare infect me. I'm important and fragile. You are expendable. Even though I'll cheer you with pots and pans for now. Maybe I'm reading something into it that isn't there. You can decide and disagree if you want.